From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we hear about the concerns of Michigan State University sexual assault survivors.
You're saying that you want to move forward, you're saying that you want to help us, and yet you're fighting the Attorney General's investigation.
Environmental groups have investigated the causes of toxic algal blooms in Lake Erie.
About 90% of the phosphorus that's causing these algae outbreaks comes from either commercial fertilizer or manure.
A look at Governor Whitmer's first 100 days.
She's set a tone that defines herself and her agenda, and I would characterize it as being positive and aggressive at the same time.
A book on the sculptures adorning Detroit buildings.
Why is there a goat on a bank? What does that have to do with anything? And they're actually symbols of cautious financial dealings.
Plus, we're going to talk cocktails, we're going to talk cake. What the heck, it's the weekend. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Survivors of sexual abuse by a former Michigan State University doctor, Larry Nassar, asked the Board of Trustees today, when will you show us you care? Michigan Radio's Shayna Roth was at the trustees meeting. Hi, Shayna.
Hey, Lester.
So what do they mean by when will you show us you care?
Yeah, this is part of sort of the ongoing story at MSU where they're trying to sort of turn the ship around when it comes to the culture over there and how they treat survivors of sexual assault. They've made a lot of changes at the school, but the survivors are still saying, look, you are apologizing to us in public. You are saying all these things in public, but in reality, you're not treating, number one, all of us survivors equally, but also you haven't really changed because your actions speak louder than your words. And during this board meeting, the current interim president, Satish Udpa, he actually publicly apologized to the survivors and read some of their names out loud.
We were too slow to grasp the scope and enormity of the offense you endured. And we failed to treat you with the respect and care you deserved, even as we sought to make amends.
This is the first meeting after a woman went public with her accusations that the university personnel told her to stay quiet after she went to them to tell them she was raped by three MSU basketball players. These are accusations. Now, I want to make that clear. Was that issue addressed during today's meeting?
A little bit, but not by the actual Board of Trustees. During the public comment at the end of the meeting, there were some people who referenced that. There were some people who came forward during the public comment and said, you know, this is an example of how you are prioritizing this sort of so-called first wave of Nassar survivors, but there are so many other survivors that you're not taking care of, that you're not recognizing. And they sort of use that as further evidence of how the school's culture isn't actually changing and continue to accuse the school of being more words than actions.
Now, when you say recognize the second wave, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah, so there was this initial wave of survivors who had filed this lawsuit that has since been settled by the school for about $500 million. And since that lawsuit, that initial lawsuit was filed, there is more survivors who have come forward, and they are currently in ongoing negotiations with the school. And they came forward today and they said, you are not treating us the same way that you treated this first wave of survivors. They're accusing the school of essentially not negotiating with them in good faith, and just in general being very frustrated with how the school is handling their treatment and sort of their lawsuits versus how things were going on with the first wave. And at one point, someone during the public comment said that you're trying to pit survivor against survivor, and that's not okay.
Although I remember the first wave having some of the same exact complaints at one point. I read the Lansing State Journal reported today that someone spray-painted the word enablers on the administration building before the trustees meeting. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, that was interesting. And I don't know who spray painted it. So I wasn't able to ask them directly what they meant. But it seemed to mean, in light of, you know, the timing of it and what had happened yesterday with the press conference by that young woman who is alleging sexual assault by basketball players. And then, of course, today's board meeting, it seemed to be accusing the school of enabling sexual assault.
So if the interim president is on this sort of apology tour and doing this apology again today at the public meeting, you know, what is going on that the words and the actions don't match up? What is the concern here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things. And one of the big ones that was brought up today as well is that MSU is still sort of continuing to fight this attorney general's investigation. The AG has repeatedly asked for certain documents from the school for its investigation into Nassar. And the school has said, we will not turn those over. So that's something that people brought up as being like, hey, you're saying that you want to move forward. You're saying that you want to help us. And yet you're fighting the attorney general's investigation. You know, come clean with everything and then we can move forward and really start to heal. So at one point, even one survivor got up there and said, I do not accept your apology at this time because actions like that show me that you're not really changing.
Shayna Roth is with our Capitol Bureau. Thanks for the time, Shayna.
Thank you.
Well, as you know, recreational marijuana was legalized in Michigan this year, but many cities across the state are not letting marijuana businesses operate, at least for the time being. The argument is that the state hasn't figured out how to regulate those businesses. But one small community in northern Michigan is in the middle of a legal and political debate that could set a precedent for the rest of the state. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has that story.
Vanderbilt is a small village 15 minutes north of Gaylord. It's about 1 square mile, has a population just below 600, and has one traffic light. Residents say Vanderbilt used to be known for its manufacturing and logging industry, with a little bit of tourism sprinkled in. But lately, it's known for something else. A debate over marijuana. When marijuana legalization was on the ballot in November, nearly 200 people in Vanderbilt voted for it. And 57% of them said yes.
Dozens of people that have come to the meetings and stood up and, you know, say that they voted for it and they want to see Vanderbilt, you know, move into the 21st century.
That's Ryan Cottrell. He was born and raised in Vanderbilt. Cottrell was thrilled when legal marijuana passed, and he thought that it would be a huge boost to the area.
You're talking more traffic in Vanderbilt. You're talking the gas stations are busier, the restaurants are busier, the stores are busier.
Anyone over the age of 21 can now have marijuana in Michigan. But it's up to individual cities and towns to let marijuana businesses operate in city limits. And Cottrell hoped that village officials would want them in Vanderbilt. But the village council, of which Cottrell is a member, said no thanks. They voted it down 5-2. Ron Bush is on the council and voted no.
I don't care if people use marijuana. They can use all they want.
But he draws the line at marijuana businesses in Vanderbilt.
Well, I think everybody from around this area would be coming to Vanderbilt to buy their pot. I really do. And that's why we'd be known as a pot village.
Bob McMaster was another no vote on the council. He says the state hasn't figured out what marijuana businesses will look like and what the regulations will be.
Voting for something that you don't know what it is just nuts.
He says Vanderbilt should wait and see what the state does, and they could opt back in when the state figures out their regulations. That argument is actually pretty common, and in most areas, that's the end of the debate. But there's something citizens can do after that. The law says if they write a petition and get enough signatures, it gets on the ballot in the next election. In January, Vanderbilt took that step. It only took 10 signatures.
And what happens then?
That's Traverse City Attorney George Powell. He's been following the case in Vanderbilt closely. Powell is reading the language of the marijuana law as I interview him, but even he's still catching up.
This is brand new. Okay, so that I mean, this is why this is interesting to me because really, what we're going to find out how this is going to work.
What happens next, Powell says, is voters decide if they want marijuana businesses in town. The issue will be put to a vote in Vanderbilt this August. Powell says the village is the only place in the state so far that has gone this route.
Vanderbilt might be a small community up in northern Michigan, but this is going to be a precedent. A precedent will be set one way or the other.
Ryan Cottrell says if voters approve it in August, Vanderbilt will be at the front of the line to open recreational marijuana businesses. In the meantime, he says he'll be knocking on doors to inform the public about what they'll vote on. Opponents like McMaster and Bush say they'll be doing the same. For Points North, I'm Max Johnston.
Points North is a new weekly show from Interlochen Public Radio. You can listen to the full show at pointsnorthradio.org. I don't know about you, but I'm always impressed with people who run marathons. In fact, there's someone right here at Michigan Radio who does that. But when I read an MLive story about Mark Baumann, I was impressed 50 times over. He is getting ready to run his 50th consecutive Boston Marathon. Mr. Baumann, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, you've run 49 of these. Any special prep for this weekend's run?
Oh, just try and get to the finish line. I had a few issues, so I'm dealing with those and hoping for great weather.
So I saw you own Bauman's Running and Walking Shop near Flint, and all I could think of is I was hoping you'd give yourself a discount on running shoes because, I mean, how many pairs do you think you've gone through since you started getting serious about running?
Oh, wow. 300-400 maybe? Wow, I never thought of that.
You know, I'm told, I wouldn't know, but I'm told your body and mind go through certain phases during the length of a marathon run. What's the weirdest thing that happens to your body during a marathon?
Well, probably the weirdest thing would be running out of energy, hitting the wall that marathon runners can hit.
But you keep going.
You just, you know, you're starting, you're burning more fat than you are sugars at that point. And there's less sugars to your brain, too, so you're not thinking as clearly as you would be prior to that.
Why run? What do you get out of it?
I think it's the enjoyment of the running, and a lot of it is the training. It's the people I train with. I mean, I have great companions that run with, including my wife, and it's just enjoyable to be with those people.
Do you have any idea how many people can say that they've run 50 consecutive Boston marathons?
One.
You're it.
No, there's one guy who has.
The one guy that has. You're going to be in that. That's a pretty elite group right there.
That's the plan, or that's the hope.
Of all the marathons you've run there, do you have a favorite? I mean, we had the tragic one, of course. I'm sure that's one of the most memorable, but do you have a favorite one?
Well, a favorite for a runner is going to be their best time. You know, that's your favorite, is, you know, either your best time or you ran with your kid or, you know, your spouse or somebody, but mine would be my best time.
Well, what was it?
2 hours, 30 minutes, 32 seconds.
So what are you running? What did you run last year?
I was 5 hours, 45 minutes.
Yeah, so it's there's quite a bit of difference between the different times. How old were you when you did the best time?
25.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could remember 25.
Yeah, same here.
That's Mark Bauman, who's running his 50th consecutive Boston Marathon this weekend. Hey, I hope you have a great run.
Thank you.
After the break, decorative figures adorn the buildings of Detroit. Garfoils, gargoyles, griffins, and even goats.
You look at a goat by the door, and why is there a goat on a bank? What does that have to do with anything? And they're actually symbols of cautious financial dealings.
We talked to the author of a new book that documents the silent statues watching over the Motor City. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In Detroit, silent guardians watch over the city. Many people never notice them as they keep vigil. But one new book exposes them, studies them, presents them, and explains them. And that book is called Guardians of Detroit, Architectural Sculpture in the Motor City. The author is Jeff Morrison, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So schools and churches and firehouses, municipal buildings, office buildings, Beaux-Arts, Gothic, Art Deco, statues of historic figures, mythical creatures, gargoyles, and grotesques of all kinds. I mean, there are so many sculpted images all over the city. When did you start noticing them?
Well, I had first taken some pictures about 10 or 15 years ago. I had actually gone to a dog show at Cobo Hall and walked past some of the buildings, and I thought they were pretty striking, and then came down one day with a friend of mine just to walk around and take some pictures. And then about fall of 2015, I was going through some old photos and came across those, and I thought, well, maybe I should try to do something with these.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did that appreciation evolved into, you know, I think I ought to do a book?
I had time on my hands. I had recently lost my job and was looking for a new job, hadn't found one, was organizing the photos, and thought, well, if I can't find a job, I'll have to make my own job. Mm. And decided to start working on this project. And as I mentioned in the preface, I thought maybe I'd get 100 pages. I didn't have any idea how much there was. And as I got down there and started taking pictures of buildings I knew, I would find more buildings along the way.
And you were talking about starting out thinking you'd do the whole metro area, and you ended up just sticking to the city because
exactly.
There's so much there.
Exactly.
Before we get into details about the figures, you photographed a lot of these sculptures, and a lot of them were several floors up, such as the sculptures on Book Tower, 13 floors up. How did you get those shots?
Well, I'm using a high-resolution camera. It's like a 24-megapixel camera. And then I'm also using a 600-millimeter zoom lens. And I'll usually snap two or three shots at a time with the automatic shutter and hope that I got what I need. And I came back to buildings several times, different times a day. It's always a matter of what the light is like. And when you first go to a building, you take some pictures and then you think, well, I need to come back at this time or that time and try to get better light on this area.
All right, for the camera buffs, I got to ask, Canon, Nikon, something else?
Canon, 5D yeah. Mark III.
The griffin is an often used figure in all of these architectural styles. Why is that a favorite?
I'm not sure entirely. Griffins are guardians of treasure. The griffin is also the name of the first ship to sail across Lake Erie, one of the first commercial vessels on the lake. It was Robert de La Salle's ship. And I think that might be part of it. But you see it a lot on police stations, which it must just have been thought of as a symbol of Detroit.
I've never quite understood the faces that you see on churches of a certain period. What was the reason for some of these really ugly and grotesque faces and figures? Because I don't make a direct connection between them and Christianity.
There's a couple of things. The main thing is that, especially when you see the gargoyles, say on Trinity Episcopal Church, one of the first buildings featured in the book, you see the gargoyles and they extend out and they look like they're trying to get away from the building. So symbolically, they're showing evil spirits or demons that might want to come in. There's no place for them here. They don't like it here. They're leaving. Why would they try to get, you know, these other ones coming up, try to get in?
So I always thought of gargoyles as guardians, but in this case, they're not. They're the opposite of it. They're trying to get away from the building. We know a lot of the architects of Detroit. We don't know many of these sculptors. You did track down some of them. How much did you learn about them?
One of the things that I found really interesting about them was how interconnected they are. You start with like Julius Melchers, who's considered the father of architectural sculpture in Detroit, one of the city's first art teachers. He taught art to Albert Kahn, among others. And then you see the people that worked with him or learned from him. They taught others, and they're working on different buildings. And then you see others, like Thomas Wagner had students that worked under him and learned from him. And you see the interconnections all the way along.
You know, if you're only casually familiar with Detroit, a lot of people are going to think about the Guardian Building, and a lot of people love that building. What's your assessment of that building and its sculpted imagery? Because it's Art Deco and a little different than a lot of the other buildings in town.
Well, the Guardian Building is exciting because of its use of color, for one thing. The bricks on the building were specially formulated for that building, and it's the largest brick-clad building in the world even today. But the sculpture on it, I think it's exciting. It's Corrado Parducci's work. I have in the book a rendering from the architectural firm, and you can see the variation between what they talked about doing or what they wanted or proposed and what Corrado Parducci ended up doing. One of the ways he worked and one of the reasons he was so prolific and worked on so many buildings in the Detroit area was that the architects trusted him. Back in the old days, late 1800s, early 1900s, somebody at the architectural firm would do a very detailed scale drawing of the type of sculpture they wanted on the building, and it was up to a craftsman to follow that. And as things progressed, all the architects of the city had such faith in him that they would do rougher sketches and just let him finish it up. As a matter of fact, sometimes Kahn on his blueprints has just an indication and it says Parducci.
So he became a collaborator instead of just a contractor.
Exactly, exactly.
I want to talk about the Old County Building sculptures. They've always caught my attention. Can you talk about the symbolism of those sculptures on top of the building?
Well, you have the four sculptures at the very top of the tower that symbolize law and commerce, mechanics, I think, and can't remember what the last one is off of my head.
It's only one of hundreds of buildings you've been looking at.
But yeah, yeah. And they're very interesting. Then you have the larger ones at the base of the tower, and they're all interesting. One reason, because of the technique, the way in which they were built. They're copper sheeting over an iron frame. And as a matter of fact, during World War II, the county treasurer proposed taking all these statues down off the building and melting them down for the war effort because he thought they were solid bronze.
Mm.
And there was a lot of uproar by preservationists, but when they found out that they were just copper over an iron frame and there wasn't that much material to be had, the statues were saved.
Yeah, I know of a lot of courthouses around the nation that lost their wrought iron fencing or things like that for the war effort at that time. In a lot of these sculptures, there's this kind of medieval atmosphere. Is this American architects trying to imitate the vintage of European buildings, or is there some other driving force behind that?
It's a little of both. When you look at Trinity Episcopal, that's very overtly designed to look like a 13th century church. Architects were sent to study Gothic churches in southern England and to bring back the best of those and sketches of the sculpture on those and to create something that looked like it was out of the 13th century. But then you get into some of the newer churches like the Cathedral of the Most Blessed Sacrament, and it's kind of a Gothic revival, and it has a Gothic feel to it, but with a more modern feel. So it's more neo-Gothic, new Gothic. And you see the overtones of Art Deco styling in this and a little more modern styling to it. And most of these architects and most of these sculptors, they studied in Europe. They went to Europe and toured Europe and learned from the buildings of Europe and then brought what they learned back here.
There are eagles and pelicans, owls and snakes, wolves and crows. Animal imagery is very common. Do these symbols have specific meanings, or do they change over time?
They have specific meanings to their time. You mentioned the pelicans. That's one of the things that got me started because Metropolitan United Methodist is right along Woodward Avenue, and I would pass it, and there's a large pelican on a church. And I would look at that and wonder, why is there a pelican on a church? And it's actually a symbol of atonement. The ancient naturalists believed that a pelican would actually kill its young because the noise that they were making bothered him. But then 3 days later, he would tear open his breast and feed them with his own blood to bring them back to life. So that's a pretty obvious Christian symbol. Another one that's very interesting that you didn't mention is the goat that you see on Bankers Trust Company. You look at a goat by the door, and why is there a goat on a bank? What does that have to do with anything? And they're actually symbols of cautious financial dealings. And if you dream of a goat walking around a farmyard at night, that means that you're going to come into some money.
Well, I've never had that dream. That might explain a lot for me.
Yeah, I'd like to have that dream.
In the 1950s, 60s, 70s, a lot of facades covered up some of these sculptures, some of the relief work, and some of them were removed, just chiseled away or taken away. During this renaissance of Detroit, does restoration include these sculptures and reliefs?
Yeah, they're actually doing quite a good job of renewing these buildings. There seems to be a real commitment to historical preservation. That being said, there are some buildings that are going to be lost, and that's a shame, even though so many buildings are being restored, like the National Theater is scheduled to be torn down. But even then, it's kind of a good news, bad news thing. That's the oldest theater in Detroit.
A Kahn building, yeah.
Yeah, his only Kahn-designed theater. But they're going to save the front facade and use it as a gateway to a pedestrian park.
Well, I suppose that's something. I'd hate to see that thing completely disappear. It looks like it was once very beautiful. You mentioned how some of these figures have deteriorated badly, some because of using coal for heat caused acidity in the air and that ate away some of the stone. Some of it's just weathering. How much have we lost just due to that?
A lot. You look at the sculptures on Trinity Episcopal Church, they're mostly still there. Some are damaged. There's one of a wolf in priest's clothing, a symbol of the worldliness of the church and a warning against that. And the snout of the wolf is broken off, and that's kind of disappointing. And then on the book building, they had to replace the nude figures holding up the cornice. They had become so damaged that they couldn't be repaired. They had to be replaced with fiberglass figures, mm-hmm. fiberglass imitations, which, to be fair, 13 stories above ground, you're not going to know.
One of the most celebrated of Detroit's sculptures and carvings might be the Scott Fountain at Belle Isle. Why do you think it's so popular?
I think it's just a beautiful fountain, for one thing. It's just great to look at in the summer. They have the lights on it at night. There's a lot of stories about James Scott, how he was not a very popular guy.
That's what I understand, yeah.
He left money to build the fountain on the condition that they build a statue of him. And there was a lot of debate about whether someone should be able to buy a memorial to themselves, especially someone that many people considered to be of low character.
We stopped seeing this kind of imagery being incorporated in much of the architecture in the last half of the 20th century and this century. What do you think of that?
I think it's a disappointment. I understand the movement. I understand the principles behind more modern architecture. But I think where that trend is being reversed, and I like to see it as a sports fan, is in sports stadiums, particularly Comerica Park. You know, all the Tigers as part of that. Or if you go to Toronto, their stadium, they have sculpture on the outside of it. And it's just nice to see that coming back.
I hate to ask this question, especially about a book that's this extensive, but do you have a favorite Detroit building or structure or image?
Well, when I was working on the book, people would ask me that question, and the answer was usually the next one, because I'd right. find a building and start shooting pictures and start doing research, and I would get very involved and into it. I think there's a couple. A Guardian building is an obvious choice, the Fisher, but I think the building that most epitomizes architectural sculpture for me and what I think of as architectural sculpture is Trinity Episcopal Church. The picture on the cover of the book is from that church. There's originally 172 sculptures planned to be on the outside of that building. They didn't quite get to that many for reasons that are explained in the book. And just when I think of architectural sculpture, I think of Gothic architecture, and I think of something like that.
The book is Guardians of Detroit, Architectural Sculpture and the Motor City. The book is rich in photos, details, and history. The author is Jeff Morrison. Congratulations. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Tammy, hi.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. Boy, you seem excited about this new ingredient. You've talked about this before.
Right. So today we're playing with St. Julien Michigan Light Solera Cream Sherry. So this is a product I've been familiar with for a while and have actually been hunting down, but I haven't been able to find it near me. So I was driving to Chicago a couple weeks ago, passed by a sign, St. Julien, off this exit, jumped off, grabbed a bottle so I could have fun with it.
Okay, sherry. I thought sherry was made in Spain.
Yes. So sherry is definitely made in Spain. And in the United States, sherry is still sort of used as a semi-generic term. So you will find things that are made domestically that are called sherries. So you'll notice this is a Michigan light sherry, right? So that's when you make it in the U.S., you have to specify where it's been made. What's interesting to me about this product is that it isn't made with the same grapes as a traditional sherry. It isn't, for the most part, made with the same technique as a traditional sherry. And yet, the finished product is very, very close to a particular style of Spanish sherry and works brilliantly as a substitute for that style of sherry in cocktails.
You know what I call that? Michigan ingenuity.
Indeed. And they've been making this since 1973, actually, at St. Julien.
So it's been around for a while.
It has. So they use a Solera system, which is a system that ages things progressively through barrels. And their set of barrels, their Solera, has been going since 1973.
I also noticed that you've got what's become a bartender favorite in this region anyway, the Norden Aquavit.
That's right. I was really excited to come across this cocktail called the Jesper Lind in the Death & Company cocktail book because it really gave me an opportunity to highlight three really nice Michigan ingredients in a cocktail.
Right. And there's the gin.
And there's the gin. Our gin today is from Ann Arbor Distilling Company, and it's their winter gin. Ann Arbor Distilling Company makes seasonal gins, and the winter one is the closest to what we would think of as a traditional gin style. The others are really quite different.
All right. How do you make a Jesper Lind?
So this is a stirred cocktail. It's probably a little bit of a twist on a Vesper, which is a famous James Bond cocktail. Y'all can look that up. So I started with 1.5 ounces of the Arbor Distilling Winter Gin, added 0.75 ounces of the St. Julien Michigan Light Cream Sherry, then 0.5 ounces of Norden Aquavit, and then just a teaspoon of vanilla syrup, and we'll put a recipe for that up on the website, and a dash of orange bitters. And I stirred that all up and served it up in a coupe like a martini would be served.
Well, three Michigan ingredients like that, that's a big swath of the state. That sounds fine to me, but I guess the real test is in the tasting. So here we go. Oh my God, there's a lot going on there. I mean, that's complex. That's really nice.
There really is a lot going on there. So this style of sherry, a cream sherry, is a sweeter style of sherry. So there's definitely some pronounced sweetness to the drink, but it's offset by the dryness of the gin and the akavit, and then just amped up a little bit again with the vanilla syrup. But I think it really does play nicely.
Yeah, I agree completely. That is magic in a glass.
Hooray! I'm really glad you like that one, Lester.
Well, you've got a second glass that looks really similar but a little darker. What's it for?
Death & Company is a New York City-based bar, so they're not using Michigan ingredients in their drink. And this comes up a lot when you're looking at cocktail books, where you may not have the very specific ingredients that they call for. And you always question, can I just substitute ingredients that I have on hand? So I thought it would be fun to do a comparison of making this cocktail with the ingredients that they actually called for. So that's what this second glass is, Lester.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll take a taste of that, too. Not as complex. And frankly, I think the Michigan one has a lot more going for it.
Right. So when we've taken this drink in a different direction, you can definitely see there's some similarities between the two. But I agree with you. I think our drink has a lot of interesting stuff going on.
You can barely note the akavit in that. It's really heavy on sherry.
Right. So the Lustau East India Solera sherry that we used in the Death & Company recipe is definitely a little bit more of a assertive flavor, shall we say, while the akavit that they used is a aged akavit and thus has a little bit less of an assertive flavor. So it definitely changes the balance.
All right. Well, I'm down with the Michigan Jesperlind.
Michigan Jesperlind for the win.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Still to come, we examine Governor Whitmer's first 100 days in office. That comes in 10 minutes on our Friday Political Roundup. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The growth of algal blooms in western Lake Erie led to shutting off the drinking water in Toledo in 2014. The blooms could lead to toxins in the water under the right circumstances. Algal blooms are a growing problem in the lake. It's been blamed on excessive fertilizer being applied to farm fields and manure runoff from livestock farms in the Maumee River watershed. The Environment Working Group and the Environmental Law and Policy Center investigated the sources of the nutrients feeding the algal blooms and found the problem is aggravated by many more so-called factory farms. Joining us now is Madeline Fleischer. She's senior attorney with Environmental Law and Policy Center. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how big is the Maumee River watershed?
It's pretty big, which is part of the reason the scope of this problem is so large, is it goes all the way from western Lake Erie, reaches even into Indiana. So it's thousands of acres.
Right, and includes part of Michigan, too, as I understand. Your investigation found that there are a lot more factory farms in the region than there were just a few years ago. How many more?
There's been a significant increase, 20, 30, 40% over the last decade. And that's key in part because a lot of these big operations don't have permits because they come in under the number of animals that at which you're required to get a state or a federal permit.
I want to define this whole idea of factory farms as also confined animal feeding operations. Give me an idea what we're talking about when we say factory farms.
So these are farms that it is not your, you know, 5 cow, 10 pigs, that kind of thing. These have hundreds or even thousands of animals when you're talking about something like poultry. But these permitting requirements don't kick in until pretty high levels.
So they produce a lot of manure, whether we're talking about pigs or chickens or cows. So what happens to that manure and other animal waste that's produced on these farms?
You're correct to call it waste. I think that's the right way to look at it. And the way that most of these operations get rid of this waste is they have some storage on site where they keep it, but ultimately they put it on fields through what's called land application, which is theoretically supposed to be for growing crops, but really it's waste disposal. And you can see that, you know, in terms of some of the rules around specific to manure that aren't necessarily keyed towards how much you actually should be putting on there if you're really trying to grow corn or soybeans or whatever it might be.
So I'm not following you there. The farmers tell me that they put the manure on, they incorporate it into the soil to be a fertilizer. That's exactly what it's supposed to do to help their crops. That fertilizer is the same thing as causing these algal blooms. So what's wrong with that?
Well, we know it's not staying on the field. Scientific consensus is that about 90% of the phosphorus that's causing these algae outbreaks comes from either commercial fertilizer or manure. And what that really means is probably during heavy rainstorms, even though it's been put on the field with the idea that it'll be taken up by crops, it's getting washed off. And that's really, something that's getting worse as climate change is causing more of these rainstorms and more severe ones. So it's something where, these may have been practices that worked, 20, 30, 40 years ago and were the norm, but they need to be revisited.
Your report says the amount of manure that's produced and applied to farmland in the watershed went up from 3.9 million tons each year to 5.5 million tons. Do we have any idea what percentage of that is actually getting into the Lake Erie, western end of Lake Erie?
More than it should be is really what I can tell you. And part of the problem here and what we're working on through this report and otherwise is getting the states and the federal government to try to figure that out in a more coherent way. The current approach has generally been to sort of throw money at the problem and hope that, that some of these big operations will voluntarily change what they're doing. And we all can see that that's not working because we're still getting the same amount of phosphorus in the lake, same algae outbreaks every summer. And there's a mechanism under the Clean Water Act where you're supposed to, use the information you have, get more data if you need it, and try to figure out where this is coming from and where you actually need to focus your efforts to get reductions, including through some robust regulation.
Now, let me push back a little bit because late last year I talked to the Ohio Farm Bureau and they say voluntary efforts are reducing the problem as evidence that the cyanobacteria toxins have not caused drinking water systems to have to shut down since 2014. Your investigation seems to be coming to a different conclusion. Why is there that disparity?
I think the credit there goes to the drinking water treatment folks. The reason that Toledo's drinking water and others has been protected from the algae outbreaks that are still happening is because they're putting in the monitoring and the treatment they need to deal with the toxins, and that's costing their ratepayers millions upon millions of dollars, with more to come. So that's a back end fix, and it doesn't mean that the front end problem of the pollution is getting any better. And in fact, Ohio EPA's own data shows that there hasn't been a reduction in the amount that's going through the Maumee or otherwise.
You did find that the amount of phosphorus added by chemical fertilizers on the farm field has actually gone down, but the overall phosphorus levels are rising because of these factory farms, these confined animal situations. Why have we seen that change? It sounds like they're making progress in one area while not making progress in another area.
I think those trends don't necessarily have to do with what anyone's been working on to address phosphorus pollution. It's just sort of, I think, where the agricultural economics are driving things. It's folks are raising more swine and more poultry, and apparently they're finding enough money there to make it worth it to build new facilities and to expand. And to us, that means that's exactly the place you want to look to do more to make sure that as these folks are expanding, they're not making the problem exponentially worse.
Well, what can be done to reduce the problem? I mean, if there's a demand for more chicken and more pigs and more cattle, the market forces are pretty strong there. Is there anything that can be done?
It's you got to have a robust set of rules. There are, common sense agricultural practices that you could institute across the board that could really make a dent. One pretty easy example is that the rules for how much manure you can put on a field actually let you put on a fair bit more manure than you could commercial fertilizer. It's got a looser set of rules. So you can put on more manure than any agronomist would tell you you actually need to grow crops. And that's something where there's an existing rule about it that just needs to be fixed so that this is really being kept to, you know, to keep folks honest that you're not just using these fields as really a dumping ground.
Is this something the Ohio, Michigan, or Indiana regulators can do or have the political will to do?
Well, I think it's an open question whether they have the political will. I think, at least in Ohio, where I am, we're seeing some movement. I think Michigan is expressed some interest and has been ahead of Ohio in terms of declaring Western Lake Erie impaired under the Clean Water Act, which gives them some more federal regulatory tools to use. So there's some movement there, but I'm not sure it's moving far enough or fast enough to help really solve the problem.
Madeline Fleischer is senior attorney at the Environmental Law and Policy Center. That organization, along with the Environmental Working Group, identified an increased number of factory farms responsible for manure pollution causing toxic algae blooms in Western Lake Erie. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Glad to be on.
Ever since FDR, pundits and reporters have been assessing a president's first 100 days in office, and that's spilled over to other executives. So here we are, 100 days into Governor Gretchen Whitmer's term in office. So we decided to ask our favorite pundits about how she's doing. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic member of the state legislature. Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. So Vicki, what is the single most significant thing Gretchen Whitmer has done in her first 100 days?
Communication. And I think that it's really important. For so long, our elected officials have hidden in their ivory towers and not really gone out and talked to people. Gretchen Whitmer has changed that dynamic by actually going out and talking to people through town halls across the state of Michigan to sell her proposals. She's also opened up a continuous dialogue with the leaders of the House and Senate, and I think all of that's important. And she's keeping ties open between her and the business community. So all in all of this communication and listening is going to help her become a strong leader in a divided government.
Ken, what's the one thing that stands out for you from Governor Whitmer's first 100 days?
Well, she proposed a plan to fix the roads, which is her signature issue. And I think also she has set a kind of established what I would call a governing persona, meaning that she's set a tone that defines herself and her agenda. And I would characterize it as being positive and aggressive at the same time. For the record, I don't like this 100-day marker. I think it's artificial. It's not really meaningful.
That's two of us, Ken.
There's false expectations that something dramatic is going to happen, and it's just not going to happen in 100 days. In her case, a more meaningful marker is going to be the 270th day, which is October 1, the start of the new fiscal year, because a budget will have been done at that point, and, you know, she's so much of her agenda right now is a function of the budget, including the road plan.
Let's talk about the road plan a little bit. The governor's gas tax proposal to fix the roads means 45 cents per gallon. That's a lot more money. She also wants more money for schools. Some of these ideas are not popular among a fair portion of Michigan voters. Why, Vicki, start with these tough sells?
Because she knows that she has to start out of the gate strong and follow through on the proposals, as Ken said, that were the signatures of her campaign. And she focused a lot on roads and education. That's reflected in her first budget proposal to the legislature. Whether it's popular or not, she has come up with a plan and is challenging the Republicans in the legislature to come up with alternatives if they don't like this one. But she doesn't want to settle anymore for piecemeal action that is not consistent to provide the funding necessary to create a robust top-notch public education system in Michigan and to fix roads that have been neglected for a long time.
Ken, we saw Governor Snyder pick up some pretty big lifts when he began his term as governor, his first term as governor. Is tackling these things like more money for schools and fixing the roads a good start, or what do you think of that strategy?
Well, it goes to what I said, one of her, I would say one of the things she has done in the first couple of months, and that is establish this sort of aggressive and yet positive approach to government. I give her credit. She's apparently willing to break some eggs to make an omelet here, particularly on the road funding. And, you know, she could have waited, but she didn't. She's positive. She's aggressive. And you got to give her credit for that. And I think that's the Governor Whitmer everybody is going to experience and see and work with for the 4 years.
You know, business groups are not completely happy with Governor Whitmer's moves to eliminate some environmental oversight panels and her questioning about the construction of a tunnel for Canadian company Enbridge Line 5 oil and gas pipelines under the Straits of Mackinac. What's that say about her priorities and her relationship with business, Vicki?
Well, don't forget, part of her plan also in education is to attract talent, to grow the talent pool, to create a trained workforce for current jobs and jobs for the future. And all of that is tied in with her relationship with the business community. And I think they want the same thing. And we all want good jobs, high-paying jobs, and we want hope for the future that our kids will be able to live, work, and play in a beautiful state. So I don't think that the aggressive nature that she's showing is really truly aggressive. I think it's called leadership. It's getting out in front. It's saying what you believe, and it's not backing down and saying, if you've got a better alternative, I'm all ears to listen to it. And she's proven that already.
Ken, what do you think about her relationship with business interests?
Well, there's just kind of a political reality here. There's going to be tension between her and the business community on some issues. I mean, after all, they by and large supported her opponent in the fall election. So that's just kind of a given, and both sides have to work through that. It's not always going to be pitched battle between them. I think the business community basically embraces the notion you need significant new money for roads. They're going to resist an increase in business taxes. They're going to resist some regulation that she probably wants. But they're just going to. The reality is they're going to have to work through those issues to make progress.
All right. We've all three admitted that we think the 100 days measurement is really kind of an arbitrary mark. Ken, you mentioned 270 days. That's the beginning of the new fiscal year. I'm wondering, how long do you have to actually watch an elected official before we can really make a proper assessment of the job?
I think it's a continuous look. And just because somebody does something great the first year doesn't mean they're going to not fall flat on their face the second or third year. I mean, witness Governor Snyder's mess with Flint. And so I think it's an ongoing process, and that's why we have elections. And I so far am very impressed with Governor Whitmer's attention to changing the tone in state government and being willing to work across the aisle very strongly. And I'm encouraged by her courage to come out with a budget document that reflects her values and what she said was important.
Ken, what do you think of that tone?
Well, politics, political leadership is sort of a what did you do for me today kind of environment. So you can have huge accomplishments and then people say, well, okay, well, what's next? But let me just say this. If this governor and this legislature can reform auto insurance and reduce rates, if they can put massive amounts, significant amounts of new money into roads and tackle education, it would be one of the most successful groups of political leaders in many generations.
There you go. There's the challenge. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Okay, so this week, public radio stations across the nation competed for the coveted title of Public Radio Cake Week Champion. And around here, there has been cake. So much cake. Every day was a different theme. Public radio cliches one day, news story of the year, surprise inside. Our Michigan radio bakers channeled their best Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood and came up with some pretty incredible creations. My favorite was the wolf leaving Isle Royale. You can see some of the photos of the cakes at michiganradio.org. As for me, I think I'm going to go eat a salad. After all, I think I ate all the cake already. Today, Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, and you know he ate a lot of cake this week. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Joey Horan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great weekend.